winter of 1852 had been one of storm and disaster at sea, and during December of that year, a lot of boats was lying windbound on the Mersey. Amongst them, a brig, the Lily, of that port, and owned by Hatton and Cookson of Liverpool. She was a ship of 169-ton register and was bound for Ambrus in Lower Guinea. She was loaded with manufactured cotton goods, 20 pungents of rum, and a lot of flintlock guns, and big knives with wooden handles for cutting sugar cane, and 61 ton of gunpowder. The captain of her was John Owen. He was an elderly man, and he had given up sea for some time and was acting as overseer for the company. But this being a valuable and destructive cargo, they prevailed on him for to take charge of her for that voyage. She was commanded by Owen and 13 men, all told. Well, we weighed anchor on the 23rd of December at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they towed her out to the bellbuoy. So the tugboat left her and the pilot, and she proceeded on her journey then, the wind blowing hard from the southwest and hazy. Well, on Christmas Eve, at midnight, they made the calf lights. There was no chicken lighthouse that time. And they put the boat round on the starboard tack, still blowing hard from the southwest. Well, on Christmas morning, it moderated a little, and she was making a bit better headway. But at midnight on Christmas Day, it came on to blow fiercely again and blew a lot of her sails away. Well, on the 26th of December, it moderated again. But at midnight again that night, it came on to blow furious, and she got in dangerously low on the Isle of Man, right on the lee. Well, on the morning of the 27th, they found themselves in the bight of the sound. So, of course, they couldn't get out of there then. So the lightkeepers on the calf ran down as close to the water's edge as they could and made signs for them to let go of the anchor when she was going up past the big head of the calf. The ebb tide was running at the time, taking them to the north, you see. So he let go of the anchor, but unfortunately it caught foul of the bobstay. And before they could get the second anchor out, she struck a reef to the south end of Kitterland and knocked the starboard bilge in, and the two masts went over the side, killing the carpenter and breaking the leg of the second mate. Well, they had to hold on, you know, then on the weather side, the seas was breaking over her terrible, and every man was holding on for his life. Well, the cook and the cabin boy was washed away and drowned. So there was an orphan boy aboard, a relation of the captain's, and the captain was holding on to him. So eventually, as the tide ebbed, he got on to the rock she struck. And there was a sea came when the captain put the little boy down on the rock. There was a sea came and washed him off and drowned him. Well, the way the mast fell, he made a kind of a bridge cross toward Kitterland, and the sailors went cross on the mast, you know, and got on another rock. And the captain endeavored to do it, but for some reason or other, probably as he was getting an old man, he stumbled, and before he could recover himself, there was a big sea washed him in. The seven, well, that was five, lost their life when she struck. Well, they got onto the mainland of Kitterland Lake, and he stopped there till about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There was no boat to take them off, and I said, oh, well, they got a boat from Port St. Mary in a cart and carried over to the Sound. Blanchdown went and took them off. Well, he took them down here and he stopped in the Bay Hotel. So, anyhow, at all, the Lloyd's agent, he went over, you know, and took charge of the ship and cargo, and engaged a lot of men to go over and save the stuff. So they went over about 4 or 5 o'clock on the morning of the 28th. Well, when they got there, there was no daylight then, of course. They could smell something burning, you know, and they were a bit uneasy about it. But however, they cleaned the cabin and the sail case out of everything, and but they didn't get any ship's papers, because them was lost with the skipper when he was washed away. But anyhow, at all, as it came toward daylight, he could see there was a hole in the deck, and he could see smoke oozing up through out of it. So the man in charge told them for to go and get some buckets and pour water down. So they did do that. They all went ashore except 6 men. And there was an old man down here, Kelly his name was. He was the only survivor out of the 20-30 men. So he, along with others, went and to get these buckets, which was about 10 or 15 yards away from the wreck. And he was coming, this was his tale. He turned to come back with the buckets, with a bucket or two or whatever he had. And he said he lost consciousness. He never heard a sound or anything. But however, when he came to his senses again, there was a man there, and he said to him, "You're the only survivor out of 30 men," he said. So that was all he knew about it. Never heard a sound. Well, on Wednesday, the 29th of December, they got the remains gathered up and put them in 3 coffins, and they were buried round the Sound. And it was a stormy day, blowing and raining, and I have heard old men say that the funeral procession nearly reached from Craignish to the Howe. So they were buried in Russian churchyard. So that was the history of the Brig Lily. The old man that told me, he died in 1903, and he would be about 64 years that time when he died. So he'd be only a small lad of about 10 or 11 years when the Brig Lily blew up.
What was his name?
Billy Nixon. And I also knew the survivor, old James Kelly, when I was a small boy. Remember him, but he survived the explosion for 40 years nearly.
Was he from Craignish?
Port St. Mary, yeah. Yeah. A very strong man, he must have been. He was only 10 yards from the wreck when she blew up. Yes. I'll sing you a song of the fishing. The fishing I knew when a boy. When our harbour with boats it was teeming, a forest of masses and sails, straight from school to be cooking a nicky, and only a few weeks with 12 to can sail on the Annie they sent me, and our skipper was old Billy Whale, the first of the fleet to leave harbour, the last to turn back in a gale. He said they'll be sure of a season, and he was good that the boy was old for you. Came the day we were ready for leaving, And so was the master of the fleet. The wind blew fair in the morning, and at hell we'd soon be in Kinsale. Strong winds, and oh well, I remember that morning. How I wish I could see it again. Old Qualtro, I still hear him calling, and a voice you could hear in a gale. Come along there, Annie, stand by the bonny lass. Are you ready, the harmony? And then cross the bay, we were soon on our way, on a course that held down to Kinsale. Strong winds and high seas off the fastnet, but seldom we failed to shoot nets. How I hated that pitching and tossing, and wished every night we'd turn back. Every midnight when shot we'd start hauling, 4 hours at that long tarry rope, wet to the shoulders and seasick and struggling to keep on my feet. It was then I wished I was home on the Challa. At times I was nearly asleep, when a voice on the deck would soon rouse me out on that rope. Old Billy would come down to see me, with a kindly broad smile on his face. I was doing first rate at the coiling. I'll have a spell, take a seat. Then the skipper would stop a while talking, loud for to keep me awake. When the fish, their tails would be flipping as they dropped in the fish room below. 5 o'clock up on deck, cleaning mackerel and frying up for 6 hungry men. And the wind may be plenty for trysels, but there was always a rush to get in. So the hulk with our fish and arrival at evening again on the ground. I was wished every Monday was Friday, and then there'd be no coiling down. We cooks went ashore every weekend through the streets of that old Irish town, discussing our boats and their sailing. And sometimes we might have a row, but them fine sunny Sundays was ending. There was talk of us leaving for home, and I'm sure we felt sorry when leaving, but we knew we would come back again. Yes. Well, that poem was written by Master Ambrose Madrill of the How. And the old man Quayle, he was skipper of a famous Nicky called the Annie. He was a very fortunate man at sea and a very hard-working man. When it wasn't fit for him to shoot nets, it was time for the rest of them to look around too. Well, I remember when I was a boy, I was going to the fish in about 1895 in a nicky called the Elna. And the crew that was in her, they were all elderly men. Looked very old to me at that time. And I'm sure there wasn't a man aboard of her now when I come to think of it much under 60. But however, there was one very old man in her. And sometimes when we'd be coming in the morning, he was a very talkative old fella, and he'd be telling me yarns when I'd be sitting up alongside of my stay and coming in along Spanish Head and over Law and Powick, you know, fine morning. And he'd be telling me, and of course I was believing every word he said, that there used to be fairies launching a big long boat down out of the sheephole when he had been a young boy. And there was one morning they came out, he said, got the boat in the water under the sheephole, and they came out, and there was 15 or 16 men in there, and they were pulling, he said they were going at a terrific rate, and they were right out across the astern, he said. And they were very little men, and they all had red hats on them. And they were pulling away out, he said, in the direction of Holyhead. So He used to say to me, "Oh boy," he said, "thou don't see them blows now." He'd be well that time. So I remember another day too, and it might have been the same day for that matter. He was telling me about big birds that used to be in on the flat rocks there. And old Bill called them big oogs. And he said they were as big as a geese, he used to say. And I have many a time thought on that that must have been the great oak that old Bill was talking about. Of course, them being extinct for so many years, if old Bill was alive now himself, he'd be about, I don't know, a good many years with 100 anyhow. Oh, he would be, because he was about 90 when he died, and he must be 20 years out dead. I remember another year, and he was telling me about a couple of boys that lived up on Glen Chess Crank, and they were out at night, going out to see their girls or something, and they came home one night, and they seen a light in the little cottage window. So he wondered that the old people had stopped up waiting for them, and he looked in through the window, and here the porridge pot was left on the at the chalet for them, you know. So they seen two or three little fairies around there, you know, helping themselves to the porridge. And when they were finished, he spit in the pot. And the boys came in, you know, and as soon as they heard them opening the door, the little fellas cleared out, but he wouldn't eat their supper that night. Oh yes, that was true enough. I know where the house was standing yet, the walls of it was there yet, if you remember. Well, Neddy Farragher, Ned DeVry, as they called him, I knew him, and I had been out at the Herons with him. And he was a man far above the average in intelligence, in my opinion. And he was a very nice old man, quiet, and always nice to everybody. And I remember he'd be sitting in the cabin of the boat, and he would pick up a piece of paper, and he would scribble away a few lines, a few verses of poetry on it, and that would be his pastime, but he had nothing else to do. And I remember he went and carved a little sea parrot for me out of a piece of wood, and it was a lovely thing. He was a very good wood carver. In fact, he was an intelligent man at any rate. And I don't know what year he died in, but he died in England. And he was a great favorite with everybody. In fact, nobody could say a bad word about him. Neddy O'Mrey's father went by Neddy O'Mrey, and his son, the poet, what he was known as when I was a boy, was Ned Beg O'Mrey. That's it. Right. Well, on the night of the 11th of May, they used to be, when they had the nets all shot and the hole empty, they used to get a torch, a piece of oakum or waste or any rag, soaked in paraffin oil and tied on a piece of stick, and they used to go around every crevice in the boat burning the witches out. I've seen that done about 54 or 5 years ago. It was done in every vote then, I suppose. They had a lot of superstitions. Now, for instance, when you're going out at the harbour, you would never turn the boat's head against the sun. Always go round with the sun. They never like to be the third boat leaving either. They'll be known for to tie two of them together, I believe, but I never seen that done. But it was the case, right enough. But however, he had lots of other superstitions. If you would take certain animals aboard of the boat, it was unlucky. You had to speak of them even, such as rats, cats, mice, or anything of that sort. And even to have a white stone on the ballast, he wouldn't allow that. And a clish stone, as they were calling it for the tie to the nets, he would never think of putting a white stone there. Whatever was the reason for it, I don't know. But I remember one time with the nets out in the field, and there was a rabbit caught in it, a little rabbit, and he said we would have no luck that season, but they were wrong. It was all right that year. I do too, I remember that little rabbit getting tagged on the nets. As regards the explosion of the Brig Lily, there was one or two things I forgot at the time, but I've heard the old woman say that lives in the house that I live in at present, that that morning when the Brig Lily blew up, there was all sorts of stuff up in the sky, burning rags and timber and all, and it fell down in the garden in front of the house, which is 2 miles away from the Brig Lily, and it killed a rosemary tree. A great big lump of burning cotton came down on top of the rosemary tree, and it killed it. And I've also heard that when she blew up, that the miners came up out of Ballycarvish mines. They heard the vibration of it down in the mine. So it must have been a terrible vibration for them to feel it down in the earth, you know, nearly 3 miles away. Yes. Well, there's a poem that was written on the raid down at the mackerel fishing in 1894, the month of April, 23rd of April. And there was a terrible destruction of nets, doing a lot of nets lost, and life as well lost. The old men speak of 94, that April day on a storm swept shore. The CT fleet was all at sea, the port Crookhaven had by Skull Bay. The evening brought a sky overcast, with a rising sea and a falling glass. Off the mizzen head and the fastened rock, by the close of day the fleet lay shot. With darkness came the rising storm. The men, no doubt, felt some alarm. To save the Annettes, their one concern, they strove from darkness until dawn. On deck, their speech failed against the wind. Their small craft nearly stood an end. Though hard they strove to save their gear, whole trains of nets soon disappeared. Daylight found most boats on the way. Shoreward they raced through the raging spray. And over all, the storm struck pole that made them fear a bad landfall. The Florence she hailed from Kilkeel, too far to lee, he hauled a beam. One raging sea, and all was o'er. Her men, her boat was seen no more. The wizard passed an anxious day, with a rudder smashed and washed away. He strove to keep before the blast, and Queenstown Harbor reached at last. And sore beset was the Amazon. One man and all her gear was gone. Yet like a wounded bird she tore through wind and sea to Baltimore. Of one more boat I have to tell, her name the Expert and her skipper Bell. Far off the land, close reefed hove to, 2 days and nights withstood the blow. The years have rolled since 94. Their men and boats are here no more. Their stories printed in no book, just a word of mouth from a man or cook. With places east and places west, the old men say them days was best.